Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you're having a wonderful Friday out there. This is a totally open line show. Anything goes. Anything you'd like to talk about, call in, and we will talk. The number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. The toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. Today has been a busy day. I was looking around at some articles in the news. There is one that was published in Disability Scoop on June 20th today by Sean Heasley, and it says, schools may be underreporting restraint seclusion, and it's kind of horrifying that they're thinking that this is a low figure, and I agree with them. I feel like this is underreporting, but when, it says that during the 2011-2012 school year, there were more than 267,000 instances of restraint and secluded reported by the nation's schools. 267,000 instances of restraint and seclusion that children in the United States have been subject to. And Heasley says that these numbers come from an analysis by nonprofit news organization ProPublica, which crunched data collected by the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. It said, this article says that among the students who were restrained, three-quarters had disabilities. Federal officials said when they first released the data in March, such children also represented 58% of those placed in seclusion rooms or some other form of involuntary confinement at school. Heasley continues that though the education department sought to gather data on the use of restraints and seclusion in every public school across the country, only a third of districts reported using the techniques even once, ProPublica found. So only a third of the districts reported, and that third of them reported 267,000 instances of restraint and seclusion. Heasley goes on to say, what's more, schools in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, the country's three largest districts, reported no instances. And so this leading to questions about possible underreporting by schools. So New York, Chicago, and L.A. Are not part of that 260,000 incidences of restraints and seclusion. And we know that they are restraints and seclusions are used in schools in New York, L.A., and Chicago. And so, you know, Heasley says that efforts in Congress in recent years to establish nationwide standards limiting the use of restraints and seclusion in school have stalled. While favored by disability advocates, groups representing school administrators have fought proposals to restrict these practices and insist that restraints and seclusion are only used as a last resort 267,000 times, of which only a third of the reporting institutions reported. So that leads to all kinds of questions. And again, if you're a young person or want to talk about issues that young people are being subjected to, please call in. Or if you're somebody who works with young people or has a child or had experiences yourself as a young person, I think we really need to educate society on the damages of these practices of restraint and seclusion, and really give people the opportunity to hear the other side of it. The idea that this is a necessary practice is ridiculous. There are so many things that one can do to de-escalate a situation that do not include tying somebody down to a bed or locking them in a room. And so the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167, and the guest call-in line, toll-free, is area code 855-346-3351. You know, and then looking at issues of restraints and seclusion, somebody posted on my Facebook page the horrific incident of a, you know, and this is the language that the news is using. This was published in the Raw story on, again, June 20th, today. And the heading of this of the story by Tom Baglioni is, quote, "Mentally ill prisoner died hooded, strapped to a chair while guards chatted nearby," the suit claims. And so the family, it says, of this person who had a psychiatric history, who was in inmate in prison incarcerated, that he died while in custody, and his family has filed a lawsuit alleging the guards stood around joking while failing to attend to his medical needs following a seizure caught on tape. And they actually have released some of the video of this, and it's really disturbing. I mean, even just seeing somebody with one of those, what they call a spit hood, on in a restraint chair, where this man had the seizure, is really troubling. And you know, Mr. Lopez was held. He had just been out of seclusion, out of solitary confinement. For 9 months, he was held in solitary confinement. And 2 days later, they put him in this restraint chair in a solitary confinement room where they're, you know, talking to him through a little cutout in the door. And a video camera caught him having a grand mal seizure. And then after some amount of time, the guards, who I guess did not see the seizure, wound up putting him down on the floor. He was shot up with Cogentin and Haldol, and sometime after that he died. And, you know, he was there for, I think, nearly a half hour before anybody realized that he had stopped breathing. It says... you know, that 2 days after, this is from the article, 2 days after being released from solitary, he was discovered by jailers lying on the floor in his cell, barely conscious. Instead of calling for medical assistance, the guards allegedly put Lopez in chains and placed a spit hood over his head before strapping him into a chair. While restrained by the chair, Lopez can be seen in the video having one or two grand mal seizures before slumping over. It's not clear if any staff saw the seizures, as the video camera filming him appeared to be unmanned. The article continues to say, prison staff eventually took Lopez out of the chair and placed him on his side on the ground, with one officer saying, "Holler if anything changes," and another one replying, "Like if he stops breathing." Hours later, on call, mental health clinicians speak to Lopez through the food slot in his door. "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" She then adds, "I can see you breathing." "Is he still on the floor?" asks one guard to another, replies, "Uh-huh." Another guard can be heard to say, "He likes it on the floor." The officers then stood by talking about Disneyland and Walmart before deciding to take Lopez out of his restraints. At 9:24 a.m., approximately 18 minutes after the video showed Lopez taking his last meaningful breath, an officer says, "We need to check this guy's pulse." Finding no pulse, prison medical staff attempted CPR to no avail. A coroner report states that Lopez dies of natural causes, likely the result of a sodium deficiency, which the family believes may have been brought on by the psychotropic medications that Lopez had been receiving. So they're continually, you know, without any regard for human life, a total disregard of humanity, the way the conditioning that the you know, guards are, that it's okay to talk about us like this, that it's okay to treat people in these ways. If you can, within your legal right, throw a hood over somebody and lock them down to a chair and restrain them in a place and hold them in solitary confinement for 9 months, you can do pretty much anything to them. I mean, and why would you see them as somebody who is just like you if these things can be done to them? And that separation between people, as some who have power and some who are then put in a position of where they need to, where they're just not seen as human. It's so deeply troubling. And so condolences to Mr. Lopez's family. And if you want to see this horrific video, you can see it on the Raw story. And the title of the article, again, is "Mentally Ill Prisoner Died Hooded, Strapped to Chair While Guards Chatted Nearby," Suit claims. And so that's one adult male in prison who was held in solitary confinement for more than 9 months. But schools are also using solitary confinement, that the euphemism for that is seclusion, and 267,000 instances of restraint and seclusion that were reported when major places such as New York, Chicago, and L.A. have not reported anything. And so it's not that it's not happening, it's just that we really don't know how often these things are happening, like electroshock. We don't know how often it happens because there's no national mandate for reporting or clear guidelines for how to report or what needs to be reported. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, or you can call in toll-free at area code 855-346-3351. And I just want to give an update. Yesterday, to everybody who came out and sent your support virtually for the 6th annual vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room, thank you for coming out and showing your support and for being there and for keeping a clear reminder to Kings County, who clearly did not want to be reminded of what it was that they had done. So thank you for coming out. Area code 202, your line is open.
Hello, Lauren.
Hi.
I came in a little late and I heard you speak about Esmond Green again. And I think that people just don't get it, you know. Someone dies, someone has been hurt, and they just want to say, well, that happened in the past, and we have rectified it. But it's just the similar to things that happened to people in the Holocaust or in slavery. You want to remember because these things keep happening. And we have to... It's a horrible thing that we have to commemorate such an awful thing, but I think it's very important when these atrocities occur that we continue to bring light to them.
I think it is important, and I do see this as the same kind of thing of where we should never forget that this happens, and still that our questions aren't answered. There's still a public health law in New York State, for example, that prevents the police from going into an institution to do an investigation. And that's one of the things that came out of the Department of Investigation's report on Esmond Green's murder, is that even the police couldn't find out what was going on in this place, and that they have the audacity to hide behind HIPAA laws.
Well, you know, I think I'm going to have to make that another battle of mine, because I said we have to decouple violence from mental health issues. We also have to have law enforcement to realize that we're not chattel. And that
police report was saying was that the police are not allowed in the mental institutions to do investigations on deaths that occur in mental institutions.
Well, you know something, I would want to see the law, but we have a similar problem happening here. I'm not in the area where I can always see that unless I get a phone call. But our state hospital used to be a federal campus, no longer. But I remember a few years ago when there was some theft on the campus, and an employee called the police, and the police said, well, they couldn't do anything because it was happening there. And I had forgotten about that until you had mentioned that. You know, sometimes what happens is there are, just like we said, urban legends.
Yes.
Police sometimes don't want to be bothered with things like this. When something happens, even if we die in custody of the police, it's not investigated the same way. You know, your life is kind of discounted. So, you know, ain't have anything to do with privacy, your and my privacy. It just has to do with release of information, but release of information by providers. So, for example, I'm going to a school here, and one of the administrators brought up something about they wanted to get some information and our Social Security numbers, but the HIPAA laws would be taken care of. And I haven't disclosed it yet. But I asked him, HIPAA, this is not a facility for mental health, so why would HIPAA laws even apply? So you have all kinds of instances where people are using HIPAA where it doesn't apply. And that's because they don't know, and it's convenient. They don't want to investigate. And I don't know if the family members of people, family members and loved ones and people like ourselves, we should start demanding when they say HIPAA, for them to quote the section of HIPAA that makes it so they can't release any information, because most of the time HIPAA does not apply at all.
Right, and so I think that, you know, one of the things that the police did, they really in the Esmond Green case, they really tried to get information and to have people be held accountable, and they just weren't allowed to, and that they also. Were barred as if somehow the psychiatric system has more legal authority than the police do. And mm-hmm. So the police took some serious objection to that, and I think that was part of what, you know, what moved Ms. Green's death becoming such a public issue. Because of the Department of Investigation's report into the circumstances of her death. And they wrote out, I mean, as far as, like, doing right by Ms. Green, this Department of Investigation report wrote out specifically every single thing that happened on the videotape and went through the four shifts that she was there. They showed that there was a falsification of the records and false testimony. They really did a very, very good accounting of all of the crimes that occurred in Ms. Green's murder. And even still, they weren't able to get at exact information, and the idea that the police don't have jurisdiction in a city hospital because there's a special commission that's appointed to investigate things and they don't need the police.
Yeah, we have the same thing here. They have, they call it a mortality committee here, and for years I've tried to get on the mortality committee and have not been, because if you have deaths, and I don't know, varies from jurisdiction. But in Washington, what they call them is incident reports. So if, for example, if there's a rape in a hospital or, you know, even in a clinic or whatever, they do have this kind of things like special treatment. I don't think that there's some special law. And now that you mentioned it, I'm going to look that up, and probably by next week I may have something to report on that. But you know, that's very true. When something happens to, it's all categorized and reported, whether it's in a hospital, whether it's a general hospital, or whether it's a psychiatric hospital, even whether it's a doesn't have to be that. If it happens in an agency or whatever, it seems like it gets the same kind of treatment. And do you know, do they quote some section of the law, or is this again?
Yeah, I'm trying to find the exact law, the exact section of the law here, but it's in conjunction with the QAC committee, and so I'm just trying to get into the report and flag exactly where that is,
because this happens a lot of times when deaths of people who have diagnosis label are discounted. You know, on a couple of occasions, I have caught a notice of a death in a post, not obituary, but a report, because usually it's the crime reporter that does it, because I don't hold these values, but I believe that other people do. When a poor person, especially a person who has a diagnosis, unless they are some celebrity or they're considered to be prominent in the community or whatever, when those things happen, they usually get a little footnote. You know, there might be maybe the person who covers the crime beat, they may have a two or three sentence says that police came to the home on a request of a person supposedly being suicidal or something like that, or the person committed suicide in custody. And unless someone writes an email or letter to the press, that's usually the end of it. And that's why I have said to people, this is a good thing to do, at least with our Washington Post and probably with other papers. If a friend or someone you know and has a mysterious death where there's questions not known, right away, if it even gets one inch in the press or even a dozen, sign with whoever. If it was reported, contact whoever wrote the story, even if it's only 2 or 3 inches. If you're in a place where there's a newspaper that has their stories online, because a lot of us don't subscribe to papers anymore as they come to your door, and they have a blog or a comment, make a comment, because when that little short story is given and they see whoever hands out who's the cover, they see it gets some interest, then it may generate a follow-up. And you can always call.
Right.
I've done that. Call and say, well, you know, I saw your story about so-and-so, and especially if it's one of those stories where, you know, it's usually the person who has the least experience that gets the obituary and those little crime beat things. You know, call them up, or if you can't get them on the phone, send them an email.
Right.
And then
generate. I think getting to the press is an important thing. In this Department of Investigation of the NYPD report that came out in 2009, so the law that they refer to is Public Health Law Section 2805-J that says that, one, every hospital shall maintain a coordinated program for the identification and prevention of medical ... malpractice. Such program shall include at least the following: A, the establishment of a quality assurance committee with the responsibility to review services rendered in the hospital in order to improve the quality of medical, et cetera, care of patients and to prevent medical, et cetera, malpractice. And so what the Department of Investigation said is that pursuant to the public health law, the quality assurance care's overall mission is to improve patient care. But under the statutory privilege established in the public health law, statements and evidence collected during the QAC process are confidential and not subject to disclosure. as a result of this statutory scheme, the Department of Investigation is not permitted to get evidence collected during a hospital's QAC process. And although the Office of the Health and Hospitals Corporation Inspector General has access to the Quality Assurance Committee material, it cannot disclose or refer that material, even if it contains evidence of criminal wrongdoing, to any party outside of health and hospital corporations, including prosecutors, regulators, and other law enforcement officials. Thus, DOI or any other law enforcement office may conduct an investigation and not know if inconsistent evidence or statements were obtained in the hospital's QAC process. The report goes on to say that additionally, the QAC process shields information from law enforcement scrutiny, meaning that an agency such as the Department of Investigation may not obtain all of the relevant evidence. And these restrictions on the dissemination of potentially critical information present serious issues, given that the purpose of any and all investigations should be a search for the truth. And so the fact that the Health and Hospitals Corporation in New York City, which has like multiple, like 20-some-odd public city hospitals, you know, and that it's a corporation, and that they can shield criminal wrongdoing from the police during a police investigation under and protected and written into public health law, again, section 2805J and I of the New York public health law, this is criminal, and it's a situation that is designed to create a veil for people so that they can get away with killing us, and that's a big part of the
situation in many places. And I'm going to check to see what aspect is, but I know that that is sort of similarly what happens in here, and that's very troubling. I always thought it was just like that they just didn't want to do anything, but it seems like they have an exemption, because what you just said was even if they find criminal wrongdoing, that they are precluded from handing it over to the police.
Right.
And the police feel as though they can't go in. So,
yeah. And so they can do whatever they want with no fear of retribution, because they can just hide behind this Quality Assurance Committee that literally, where it specifically states that criminal wrongdoing does not have to be released to the police. So how can the police do an effective investigation if they can't find out about criminal wrongdoing of the psychiatric professionals of the psychiatric places? That there's that's why it's like they're above the law. You know, well, we'll have our own system of law and determine how things go here. We don't need the police.
State law is in violation of people's civil rights. And
oh, yeah, it certainly is. Area code 970, your line is open. Would you like to jump in?
Yes, Lauren. First, I'd like to say thank you for sharing about the Facebook post I sent you, because this is in Colorado, and in the paper, like the other day, you even posted it on your Facebook that Colorado agreed no longer to have mental health people be in isolation just because their mental health, you know, which was happening. And this incident that I shared today on Facebook was actually taking place a year ago. March was a year. And it got no attention at the time because the warden of the prison was murdered in Colorado. And it's a separate incident, but the two occurred like a day apart. If you read the article, it almost happened the same day. It was not the same day, but close to the same day.
Okay.
And, yeah. And so for a year, more than a year, the whole story was ignored until this website that I liked, the Raw Story, posted it on their Facebook page. And it's beyond criminal. It's a total disregard for lives, because the people who watch the video, you'll see, you haven't been breathing. I mean, if he hasn't been breathing, why make it an out vocal statement? You haven't been breathing for 4 minutes. Are you okay? He's legally dead then, you know. And they
right.
waited. It was like 16 minutes, if I remember correctly, before they even went in there to do CPR. And it was
right,
half an hour
they even,
after
before
he
they
stopped
even
breathing that
it, right.
they stopped. You know, it was a total disregard because their perception is this guy's mentally ill, he's playing with us, or he has less value than any of the other inmates because he not only committed a crime, but he has a mental health issue, or according to the world, a mental health issue. We don't know from the article exactly what his mental health issue was, but that he had an extensive history before he was in the prison. So, you know, me, I'm a law-abiding citizen, but who's to say if I go into an emergency room and they find out that I have a mental health history that they would do the same, even though they're there to save my life. But I could purposely stop breathing for 4 minutes. What? It's crazy, but it can happen. And it's happening in the state I reside in, so it's really scary. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I don't believe in mental illness the way my doctor sees it. Clearly, that we're not going to agree. Or my L doctor. I don't have a psychiatrist right now. But my psychiatrist and I could not agree on what I believe. And basically she said, well, when you get yourself in trouble, I'll still be here. You know, it's like, you know, telling her I have no intention, I have no symptoms, I don't intend that the symptoms will happen again, and if they do happen again, I won't go to you because you're just going to give me drugs when I clearly know that learning how to cope with life is a better solution than taking a drug that's going to impair my judgment.
Good for you.
Yeah, right. And the thing is now, though, is unfortunately, I'm all for the, you know, anti-psychiatry movement, but reality is, as hard as we work to get it out in public that psychiatry is a fraud, not the likelihood that our message will be adopted as policy is little to none. So how, as a person who's been marked and diagnosed for 20 more plus years, how do I live and get what I need, because I have physical disabilities, without the doctors being biased because I've had a previous mental health diagnosis? And, you know, how do I live with this? Because I've gone to the emergency room for physical health and been treated poorly, or they stop if it's, you know, you get a blood test and if there's nothing, you know, totally red flag and it shows that you're basically healthy and there's no life-threatening illness, they
right.
basically treat you, you know, they don't have to do CPR and you know, intubate me or something drastic. The fact that I'm having chest pain and there's no total obvious reason, they treat me like, why did you come? This is all anxiety-ridden. You have no problem. And then it ended up to be a broken rib, you know. And I told them I have chest pain, but I know it's not my heart. But and they weren't going to do an x-ray, but they did one. And they were like, oh, you have a broken rib. That's why you're having this pain. But prior to actually evidence to see a broken rib, they treated me like, you know, you're here for anxiety. Why did you come? And it's really hard to live that down. So how do I live and exist when psychiatry basically has ruined my life previously, but now the history of that, I mean, I need to go on. But just going to a new doctor, you know, I'm going to see a new doctor in a whole different part of the state. And what do they want? They want my previous records in order to treat me. Well, you know, the previous records will say...
What I've done, if you want to, after you get finished telling your story, if you're really asking a serious question, I can tell you what I've done and what I've done with other people, because people call me when they have to go to the emergency room after you finish, if you wish,
yeah,
you want
to. Basically, though, the question I want to propose is, I mean, a person who has a history of mental health issues, they could be stopped for a traffic violation, and... I mean, one time I went unconscious, and in my wallet was an ID that showed that I attended a mental health center, and I all of a sudden the way they were caring for me changed, and I didn't disclose the information, but once it was found out, I was treated very poorly. And, you know, I could sit there and say, don't treat me like I'm a crazy person. I'm not crazy. Well, I just proved their point. I'm crazy. Because, unfortunately, even the doctor said, you know, you are being grandiose to think you're not mentally ill. Or you're angry since, and then I'm like, since when does anger, being angry, makes you mentally ill? Or is a symptom. Anger should everybody gets angry. And the whole thing with mental health is they're making everyday lives and problems a mental illness. And that's where, I mean, potentially everybody will have a mental illness. I mean,
right. Well, that's part of the goal. Yeah, for sure.
They want to explain all human behavior. And no one will be not subject to having a mental health diagnosis. That's what I one time I heard this woman, what's her name, Paula Kaplan. Years ago, there was a mind freedom conference here in Washington, and that was what she was saying is that, I think that time it was DSM-3 or DSM-4. She said it's to explain, they want to be able to explain all human behavior. So no one probably would be able to escape not having a mental health diagnosis.
Yeah, and I think that this is a really important issue. And, you know, there are like 6 or 7 basic human emotions, and there's happiness and surprise, which may or may not be a good emotion. And then there's sadness, fear, disgust, and anger. So why are people miserable all the time? Because the majority of our emotional capacity are negative emotions. But to say that anger is a psychiatric label, or is that it's a quote-unquote symptom of a label, is ludicrous. There are plenty of things to be angry about. And, you know, that this is, you know, the fear, the real necessary fear that people experience who have psychiatric histories, because they now are, you know, if they're going to a doctor for a medical reason, that their medical conditions are overlooked because they have some kind of psychiatric mark on them. And I think that this is so important to educate people about. I think with the real push of people saying that the evidence of it is the disacknowledgement of it or not having insight into it, I think that, you know, if you don't disagree with them, but then that puts you in a place of where you're betraying yourself, right? Having to admit something that you don't agree with in order to be free from it. Because if you are asking for assistance or asking for medication or any of that kind of stuff, they say no to you. And so if they force it on you if you say no, they say you must. And so it's a terrible, scary thing. And I also have experienced these kinds of things, Maria. And so I'm glad that you're, you know, bringing them up, because I don't know what the actual answer is of how do you get doctor to accept the anti-psychiatry position when they've been indoctrinated into the idea that that is the truth and that they are, you know, assisting you and it's for your own good, you know, for them to do what they want to do to you. But it's a real problem. And with electronic medical records and things like that, it's going to become an even greater problem. And
It's harder if you live in a small city, a small town or community where you don't have many choices. But you can, you know, interview people. I have had had to interview the people, and they don't have to. In other words, if you choose to still use services of a psychiatrist, So I have a doctor who has never used diagnostic language with me, and I've had him for a long time. And I had to, early on, because I had never had one, even though I had been in seeing a psychiatrist, mental health since I was 7 years of age with some break. But I don't try to convince them of that. I have a good relationship with my doctor, and I have to say that I feel as though he may not say this. I feel like I've taught him some things, too. And when you find someone that thinks of you as an expert on your own self and not able to see you just as another mentally ill person, I know it's difficult if you live in in a small community. But there are people that are out there that you may not, they may not be able to stomach you saying that there's no such thing as mental illness. They, if you still feel as though that you have to go there, and they're psychologists and psychiatrists, and try to, you know, shop around. One thing I can say about what you were saying about the emergency room, and I hope that if somebody else is on the line from D.C. that knows me and has been to a hospital with me will know this. We have, I don't know how many hospitals in the area, because we're tri-area, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And it's not possible. I'm not that well-known in our private hospital. But one thing I say to people is this. Do not go to the hospital by yourself, or if you do, have someone meet you there or to call. Because when I go to emergency rooms with other people or meet them there, one thing is to put them on notice that somebody else cares about you. Doesn't matter if there's a mental health history, because when you tell them what kind of chemicals you're taking, they know that it's there. But if they're on notice that there's somebody else that cares about you and they're checking up on you, and I hate to say that it should be your word alone that this is a physical problem, but sometimes it is not. Even for getting service, people say, Yvonne, you got to go with me because I know when you go, something will happen. If someone is really having an emergency, and you can get to figure out what hospital to go to. I know in my area what hospitals to go to that will give me respect. There's a hospital that's 2 blocks from my house. I very rarely go to that hospital. I go with other people because they've gotten better, because people do things that I'm doing. I do not stand if it's a real emergency, and I'm not belligerent, for someone to wait 2 or 3 hours. I know that I can go somewhere else where someone would triage the person and do it. It's helpful if you go to a hospital that your physical doctor has privileges at. And that can be helpful in doing that. And I'm going to give you my email or my telephone number at the end of the show if you want to talk more about it. But you can get good service by doing that. And I've had the experience, too, when I've gone to a doctor and they would say, bipolar patient, or, you know, what are you doing with your days? I don't have that happen to me now, and I try to, when we have discussions to people, how not to let that be the focus of what is happening. But you can do that. It's hard if you live in a place where there's only a few thousand people in your community, and maybe there's only one hospital to go to. But even then, it's go to the hospital where your physical doctor has privileges. Even call your doctors. If it's something that's really urgent and you have a regular doctor, call his service and tell them that you're – I do this all the time with other people that they don't have problems, like they have pain problems. They don't have their pain medication. They need to get something. And, I mean, this happens like at least for me maybe once or twice a month. Not me personally, but for people that I know and that I've assisted. And you have to do that. You have to plan for emergencies to say that if I have an emergency through the urgent care place, if it's a hospital I go to, you call your doctor's service. You may not get him on the phone, but there'll be somebody else on call.
Right,
and,
but I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that if you have a doctor, that's definitely something, and I think going to these places with somebody, that's a really good point, that, you know, it positions you as somebody else if you've got somebody who, quote-unquote, cares about you, and that's a sad reality. But when you're trying to find a doctor, and you're trying to find a doctor who is going to take your physical issues as what's important and not all of this other, stuff, how do you do that? And so, you know, it is finding out somebody's practice theory, looking at reviews of doctors on, like, Angie's List or other kinds of medical review kinds of places. And then also, like, sometimes DOs are different than MDs in the way that they treat things that are considered psychiatric, or a doctor who practices is, like, homeopathic or who believes in alternatives in general. But how do you even have that conversation with somebody without then fearing that you're going to be caught up in the way they are? And because they look at us as less than human, how do you challenge that? And
what
do
you
Lauren?
So, Maria, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying anything that you guys are saying is wrong or inaccurate. What I'm about to say is I don't know a doctor who could do those type of treatments, that would accept my, if they accept insurance at all, that would accept Medicare, Medicaid. That's one. And two, those things are more likely to happen if you can pay $200 every time you go visit a doctor.
Right.
Okay? Which is not my case, okay?
Right.
And I've been on benefits since 1992. And in 1992, I got benefits. I applied in March. I got my first benefit check in April 1st. So I did see a psychiatrist, Social Security psychiatrist. So they felt that I was so seriously mentally ill that I needed immediate attention, because even back in 1992, I was told it may take years before I ever see a first check, and I got it in less than a month of actually submitting. So I've been on the system that long, and I make it. I mean, when it's paid check to check, I'm telling you, it's really 2 weeks. I have money maybe, and the rest of the month I'm just living on luck. And, you know, I've always been able to pay the rent, and that's all that matters to me, because I don't want to be homeless again. But these tips are not necessarily wrong or not true. It's this likelihood that someone on the benefits I get, that I can afford even one visit with any doctor, health, psychiatric or non-psychiatric, because there are psychiatrists who don't necessarily believe in medicine as the first treatment. They even will say supplements as the first treatment, or, you know, but these doctors are not affordable to a person on Social Security or Social Security disability. They're not within your range. And what is available, often you're at odds with the system because basically I don't care why you're on benefits, whether it be a purely physical reason or a physical psychiatric reason, doctors want someone who will take their meds, whether it's a medical issue or a psychiatric issue. They want someone who's going to take their meds, do as they're told, not to question, you know, oh, you're giving me this med, what will it do to me, and how will it affect all the other meds I'm on. They don't want, you know, you're supposed to give them all that information, but doctors are not pharmacists. And I've had psychiatrists even say, oh, let me refer to the pharmacist before I prescribe this. But, you know, why would you even prescribe it to anyone if you didn't know enough about it to prescribe it to me? So
it's a whole system. It is a whole system, and these are the realities that you're making, bringing to light that this is part of the problem, because Medicaid and Medicare pay for, you know, bare bones, the least that they can, the most services for the least amount of money, and they're not providing a whole array of alternatives, doctors that support alternatives. Yvonne, were you going to say something?
Well, I don't know, but maybe things are a lot better here than I think it is, than it is in other parts of the country, because here I don't have traditional Medicaid. I have Medicare, and I have Quimby. And like I said, I can just share this with you. I can only speak for my experience and experience I have. I know people that go to public mental health, and they get horrible service. And I ask, but try to educate them when I have rap groups and things. And I ask people when we do peer support, I said, if you get such horrible service, why are you going there? They say the same thing that you're saying. They're saying that some of them, I've had people that I've mentored for a long time, even in this year, that said, do you mean to tell me, Lauren, I don't have to go to public mental health? I said, but I thought they were the only people that pay. There are people in private practice that take Medicare and Medicaid all day long.
It's getting fewer and fewer, because I had gone to a more metropolitan area than I was even in Denver, and I went to New Jersey, the tri-state area in New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania, and I would get referrals to doctors who were supposed to be exceptionally and would think the way I think and take Medicaid and Medicare. And then I would call them up. I would even speak to them themselves, and they'd say, you know, last month I took Medicare and Medicaid. This month I don't, and I'm sorry. Unless you have nearly $500 for a first intake visit and $200 for every subsequent visits, I can't see you because I don't take. And the reason that is because there's so many people out there who have the money to pay for that fee, that because people don't realize when they get involved with a psychiatrist that psychiatry is a fraud. So they're going to them thinking they have the answers, mm-hmm. and before they're educated to know that psychiatry really isn't even a science. It's all guesswork. And it's hypothesis. I mean, I have been diagnosed with not only bipolar, but that other dreaded diagnosis of a borderline personality disorder. And I've had therapists who are PhDs say, you clearly are not a borderline personality disorder, but I can't do anything to take that away from you. And most... So I have yet to have a psychiatrist willing to drop that diagnosis, even when there's no evidence. I mean, I only received the diagnosis that because after starting psychiatric drugs, I did self-harm things. At 29 years old, I had never done it before, but I started medication at 29, and one of the side effects was I learned how to cut. Not from anybody, but it wasn't that I learned it from another patient. It was something that those meds that I was on put in my head. Because I would have never harmed myself prior to taking psych meds. But only because of that feature of the borderline personality disorder did they diagnose me with that, because I have no problems with relationships, you know, and anyone who is knowledgeable about mental health that knows I got that, that I shared that diagnosis with, they're like, no way, that's not you. But it was just because I cut and burned for like a year after I was diagnosed with and took meds for bipolar, I got that diagnosis, and I can't get rid of it. And though I spent 4 years working with a doctor about bipolar, when she realized I was also had the diagnosis of borderline, her attitude totally changed. All of a sudden, my theories and my word wasn't good enough, and I was grandiose and angry, and because all of a sudden she realized I had the borderline diagnosis. And for me, that's heartbreaking, but you got to think, I used to think, why aren't people fighting this? Why aren't people taking their stand? Until I got the gumption to take that stand, and instead of being respected, I was sort of more, not only that I was even more mentally ill than originally thought, but I was an angry mental health patient, and that's got to be the worst kind of mental health patient. People will shy away from an angry mental health patient. I've been in the system, a public health system, for 22 plus years, and if you go in there and you do what they say, and you don't get into trouble, you're the star client, and they will think you're gold. But you question them, you challenge them, you don't take your meds, they are going, you're non-compliant, you're a troublemaker, you know. And it's heartbreaking for me, because, you know, I'm starting in a new community, and I'm still faced with the same old challenges of just to go see my doctor.
What would happen if you quit?
No, I have quit my mental health care. Okay, unfortunately, on my medical record, it is clear that I've had a psychiatric history.
I got you.
Okay, so it's not even that I'm being troubled by, because I moved to a new community. If I don't sign up for mental health here, no one's going to come in after me unless I do something that is close to being illegal, you know, because where I live now, no one will bother you unless you do something to draw attention to yourself. And that then will be considered, you know, they will easily see that, oh, you're mentally ill.
But even you're just talking in general for general medical assistance.
Right.
But because you have this psychiatric history on your records, that they're going to that rate. And so it never leaves
and
you. And so something that happened decades ago is still, you know, at the core of the problem.
Well, the thing is I'm receiving benefits still after 22 years, and after 20 years, I went to the Division of Voc Rehab and said, you know, I'm doing really well mental health-wise and physically, because I have physical disabilities. Will you please help me get a job in some way, help me go to school, help me get some level of job other than, you know, I don't mind getting paid minimum wage, but I do mind going from benefits to a cashier. I mean, I can't survive as a cashier. You know, cashiers don't get benefits for working as hard as they do. And so help me get a better job. And they just turned around and said, you've been on benefits so long, it would be too hard for us, no matter how healthy you are, it would be too hard for us to get you a job because you've been unemployed for 20 years. And I'm young, I'm only 51, you know. And to be told that basically, especially in this economy, there's no way you can be employed because of your history, you know, but yet I get that questionnaire from Social Security every year, every 2 or 3 years, whatever it is. You sure you're still disabled? You know, have you spoken to your doctor about going back to work? You know, no, I went to your own people and they said I can't, you know.
Well, I empathize with you having such a hard time. One of the things that I try to do, I'm a little bit older than you. And in fact, mm-hmm. I'm going back to school now. But I'm just saying, I like to say positive things to people. And I don't like to talk out of the boxes. Sometimes we have to go to other places other than the traditional mental health places. You know, if you're a 50, depends on where you live. Some people consider that to be a senior.
I lived in big cities, and believe me, it's not accessible to a person who doesn't have a financial means. Because if I had financial means, I could find a doctor, a psychiatrist, a therapist who would sit around all day and be positive with me, encourage me, and help me get through to a more productive society. I live a very productive life, but by society standards, because I don't go out to work, I'm not one of the productive people in the world. I mean, when they go to segregate us, they're going to first go to the Social Security rolls and get those people, you know, regardless of what your diagnosis is, because they're on benefits, you're not considered productive. But yet, on benefits, they don't allow, I mean, if you could save $2,000, they'd take it away, you know? The rules are to keep you down, not to help you up, and that's the real crime. The real crime, the real shame is in the federal government, not with what struggles I had in my life. And unfortunately, being on benefits has ruined my credit because of the funding source. You know, I even went and tried to go on and declare bankruptcy so I could clear that. So when, I mean, this was more than 10 years ago, with the hopes of going back to work, but I didn't want to go back to work owing all this money and having my work being garnished. And I tried to get a bankruptcy lawyer to help me so I can start over new. And they said, stay on Social Security. These people can't touch you. They can't touch your money. But when I do that, when I don't declare bankruptcy, when I don't work, even though I'm getting that government check, I can't go further because the government check isn't there. And they literally only give you enough to pay a low-income rent and just enough food to survive and the light bill and the gas bill, and then they give you money to help you do that much, okay?
It's a change. It's definitely a change that's there.
But the problem is they blame me, society blames me for being lazy and unproductive, but if anyone knew me in my daily life, I'm neither of those things, you know?
Well, there are things that people do, some people have found, not maybe, it varies where you live and what's available to you. Many people who are on benefits are part of an underground economy. There are people that dog sit. I think of a young man that I remember getting out of the hospital. I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. But he liked doing lawn care work. And another two other guys were just like smooth talkers. And they would go in neighborhoods and make arrangements for him to do lawn care. And, in fact, I made up some flyers and stuff for them in some cars. And we set up a PayPal account so he would go and do lawn care. These guys, all they did, the other two guys, was they go and make the arrangements because he really was non-communicative. People do things like that. Unfortunately, they're forced to kind of do things under the table because, as you say, even though that we have lots of, there are lots of incentives for people to go to work, but people are afraid, and also the reporting requirements scare people off. But,
right.
But there are things like tickets to work. There are things like working.
I went to that. You got to remember that I was told when I went to that, even though I was physically able to work, I was told because it had been so long then I worked that I was unemployable. So it wasn't. I was unemployable because I hadn't worked for 20 years. That's what they said out of their mouth. They wouldn't even make me a client of theirs. I was always an applicant in process because, and this went on for 6 months, because I had to prove to them I could work. And I did volunteer work, and they were like, that's not good enough. So I retained a status of applicant in process until I just said, okay, you obviously aren't going to do anything for me. I'm tired of playing the game. And the thing is I find satisfaction in volunteer work. So I have no problem with doing volunteer work, but it doesn't put food on the table. It doesn't help me get my clothes. It doesn't help me.
Right, and the people who are supposed to assist you in getting into rehab or VESED or whatever they call themselves
mm-hmm.
these days, vocational educational services have said to you, no, you've been out of work too long, and so you're not employable. So any desire that you have to work, might as well forget it because we're not going to help you. And they get to keep their jobs. Right,
and even with school, I had to prove that I could attend school and get grades. Yeah,
they tell me the same thing. They say I've had people come to me privately and told me, says Yvonne, you're not going to get any contracts or work because they're not going to have someone like you, regardless of the fact that you might work well with people. They don't want someone of your age crawling up on the bridges or whatever else. You know, and sometimes it's the politics of it. It's not really that. But,
and the only reason why I've survived this far and have the quality of life I have is because I have a faith in a God that has supplied me with my needs. I mean, I couldn't afford a computer if it fell on me, but a member of the church gave me a up-to-date 28-inch screen monitor computer, and another friend from church let me use their internet because I lived close to them. These people have come beside me because of my faith, and God has put these people in my life that I've been able to do things and live a decent quality of life, but I haven't paid anything out of my pocket for these things. It's always by the goodness of God and people that who have bothered to get to know me, giving me these things. And I don't know if you guys have seen the thing on Facebook that says, how could someone on food stamps have an iPhone or something like that? And the judgments on what a person who are on benefits has is, you know, everybody on benefits is screwing the government. That's the attitude. And it's not true. It's only because of God and the people he put in my life that I have what I have, from the clothes on my back to the place I live to even at times the food I eat. You know, that, you know, Christians have said, oh, we'll buy you healthy food. Would you accept it? I had a man say that to me from church, and he supplied me food for 4 years until I moved away. Mm-hmm. You know, but I wouldn't have had that healthy food if God didn't put these people in my life. So the quality of life I have is good, but it's not because of the federal government or the state government. It's because people have seen who I really am and has truly offered me help.
And I've had
pro bono psychologists that have helped me, and those relationships often end abruptly because they either decide they're no longer going to be a therapist. I've had that 3 times. Pro bono private therapists who decide it's time to hang up my shingle and go and retire. And these were people that were seeing me for no money. So I know everything's possible, but I'm telling you, it's getting harder because these therapists and doctors have plenty of patients out there or clients out there who have the money to pay for it because that money is there because everybody wants a quality therapist. Everybody wants a quality psychiatrist, but not everybody can afford it. So I appreciate what you said, and it's true, but it's really the exception that someone gets all these things. And right now I don't want a therapist and I don't want a psychiatrist, but I do want quality physical care. But in order to get the care, I have to give them my past medical records, and my past medical records are loaded. Even if they didn't put anything in that, I know the records say a mental health client, but if they just have to look at the type of medications I've been in the past, and a halfway decent knowledgeable doctor will know, oh, these are psychiatric meds. They might not know what the meds actually do, but they will recognize them as psychiatric meds. So we live in a world where there's this, it's beyond stigma. It's way past stigma. I hate that word because it makes it light. It's
right.
A bigotry. They don't see anything wrong with crushing the civil rights of a person who's mentally ill because of, obviously, they don't know any better. And that is a lie. Unfortunately, when a person who has a mental illness or has known to have a mental illness stands up for their rights, they're in their symptoms. They're extremists. They're dangerous because they're going to come at us with illegal guns or, because, every person who has mental illness can't go and get legal guns, And unfortunately, society has backed up that view with all these mass murderers, but unfortunately, it's psychiatry that's creating these mass murders with their psych drugs. But when we point that out, we're this crazy one, not the psychiatrist. I cannot believe a psychiatrist who goes through what they go through to get their MD and their specialty training can't see clearly the same stuff I can see who's got a high school degree. Why do they believe that there's anything scientific about psychiatry? I don't know.
Because public is being lied to. And the government and the industry are in collusion with each other about it, and the media and I think, Maria, what you're bringing up are really important issues, and I think this adds to the reason why we wind up dying 25 to 30 years sooner than other people. First, there's the obvious issues of what the drugs are actually causing, physical problems.
Mm-hmm.
Diabetes, metabolic syndrome, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, tardive dyskinesia, liver, kidney failure, all these kinds of things. But then there's this also other huge issue about actually getting medical attention from a medical doctor and not having things written off and people being afraid to go to a medical doctor.
That's 20 to 25 years, though. That study was only in the mental health system and public mental health.
I'm not a professor of
psychiatry, but this is why I encourage people to sometimes see the mental health system if you can, everybody can.
But what Maria is talking about is she is out of the mental health system, right, Maria? You're out of the mental health system.
Currently, I am not under any mental health system. And, you know, it doesn't matter who's prescribing the drugs. If you're taking those drugs, your life is going to be shorter. Your life isn't shorter because you're in the system. Your life is shorter because of the meds that you're taking. You know,
right,
whether or not
I'm
paying for the meds out of my pocket or my private insurance, or I'm getting it from Medicare or Medicaid, it doesn't matter where the money for the drugs are coming from. The drugs are still there to shorten your life. I have in my family a strong history of dementia, all right? And I told my psychiatrist I'm not willing to just take any drug anymore because I already have this history of dementia in my family that'll shorten my life. And, I mean, it's very, very strong in my family. And you're asking me to take meds that are not proven to actually help anything. And I looked into, you know, people with dementia, and they're often given psychiatric drugs to control their behavior. So it doesn't matter what your illness is. These psych meds are just about controlling your behavior.
Yes.
And
I agree with that 100%. I'm just saying that the high prescribers, people that prescribe, when people get this cocktail of medications, that the public mental health system is a more blatant, not saying that others don't do it, but some people over-prescribe. You know, where people are on multiple antipsychotics, multiple mood stabilizers. And in my situation that I've hit personally, my doctor has been pushing me off of medications. I only take one, and I wind down, and I'm almost off of it. But I'm just saying that if you're going to if you're no longer in the mental health system now, and everything's going well for you, and it's working well, and you're going to a private doctor, those histories are very thick. You know, to think that they sit down and read everything, I'm just saying I would try to go in positively, find a primary care doctor, and not talk to them about your mental health history. You know, if you're not taking
I'm not going to. I'm not going to. That's not the question. The question is when she sees my medical records, she'll see. I've seen my doctor's reports, and it says my name, a mental health patient at the mental health center, and they name the center, and that's in the first line. And then they start talking about my health issues. It is that blatant. It's that out there that my mental health history is there before my physical history is there. Okay, as well as I happen also to be obese. And that is, you know, it doesn't matter what all my other physical problems are. That's the first one they put out there. And believe me, just being obese, even before, you know, before they know anything about my medications at all, before they even hear about it, just being obese and walking into a treatment site, whether it be an emergency room or a doctor's office, there is that barrier too. So I have more than just mental health barriers, but the prejudice against people who happen to be overweight or obese. But yet when I went to try to get a medical intervention about my obesity, the reason why I didn't have that intervention was because I refused to take psych drugs. So,
well, you know, I have, try to be positive. Being positive about going in with an expectation of good service. I think I know that you've had a hard time with these things happening. I haven't had necessarily a rosy picture. I go with other people to doctors and to hospitals. But if you come in with the expectation that you're going to get good service and
what you're not realizing is that I do go in there positively. When I went to a surgeon who was supposed to help me by making my stomach smaller, okay, I came in there. We had the most positive conversation. He was like, I can help you. But part of the screening for that operation is to have a psychiatrist or a licensed healthcare professional say that I can handle the operation. And I had two referrals that said, oh, yes, she knows what the operation is all about. She is committed to doing what you're asking her to do. But I wouldn't suggest the operation because she refuses to take psych meds. And the final report from the surgeon was, I'm sorry, basically these were not verbatim, but I'm sorry that I have to refuse this operation because you clearly know what you're getting into, but I can't go against the recommendation that I shouldn't have the operation unless I take psych meds.
Did you know that? Did you know that when you went to them? Did you know that they were going to say that?
Excuse me?
Did you know that they were going to, did they tell you, these two other consultants on your supposed emotional health, did you know that they were going to make that statement?
No. No. The first one, it was the current psychiatrist I was seeing. The second one was a totally non-prejudiced psychologist. And what she told me was, I don't believe that you should have this operation without psychiatric intervention. And I said to her, I am currently seeing a therapist, and I will have that therapist with me for this process. She goes, no, I'm not talking about therapist. I'm talking about a doctor that can give meds, because I don't think you should have this operation without meds. And she was a psychologist. And I was prevented from having that care because, just because I said, I mean, I wanted the operation so I could reduce my risk of dementia, which one of the risks is being obese or overweight. Increases your chances of getting dementia, which my mother has very severely. Okay? And they wanted me, in order to have this operation to help me lose weight, in order to have the operation, I had to take drugs that could cause the dementia also. So I'm like, why should I increase my risk in one area to reduce my risk in another? It's negating both what I'm trying to do. And when I explained that to the surgeon, he was like, my hands are tied. I respect your decision not to take meds, but I cannot have this. I cannot give you this operation without a licensed mental health care professional saying you should have it under the conditions that you want it.
You know, that was the only reason why they rejected you. Wow.
So the only reason why I couldn't have it was because these mental health professionals decided that I shouldn't be off medications to have the operation. But I passed all. I had to see a cardiologist and have a stress test. I had to see a sleep specialist. I had to see a series of doctors, have a series of health screenings, physical health screenings, which I passed at what they called a moderate risk, because I am morbidly obese, so there was some risk. But the mental health, and it was only because 20 years I was compliant, and the last 2 years I haven't been, and they just see that I've been on meds for 20 years, and you could never go through all this without being on meds. It is horrible. It is prejudice, and I have many prejudices held against me. But mental health has got to be the worst, only because in society it's okay to be obese, but if you're mentally ill and obese, oh, I tell you, I don't know if anyone else could relate to that, but the stigma and the fright on people's faces okay? Who, and of course, how many people know about an angry fat woman? You know, I can't tell you how many comments I've heard about other angry fat women, you know, whether that they have a diagnosis or not, they're all crazy, you know. So it's what is perceived out there. And you talk about, you know, hey, you know, think about psychiatry. These are the facts. Don't you see that what you've been told is wrong? And I can't tell you how many people will look at me and say, you just don't want to accept you have a mental illness. You know, I honestly could say there was a point where I was med compliant, and I might have agreed with people that those people who refuse to take their meds are sicker than us who are taking the meds. I have since changed that point of view only because I had side effects. Mental illness also runs in my family, and I have a cousin who has been on meds longer than me, but now his life is at risk because it has so affected his liver and kidneys to the point of being hospitalized and extremely sick. So I'm going to stay on psych meds with that kind of future ahead of me? No. I'm just grateful for every day I'm alive and I'm able to get up, walk around, take care of myself, and participate in life. But that's great, but that doesn't mean I sit around and just do that and shut up about the injustices in the world. I mean, there's a multitude of injustices. How many people who are in the system, mental health system, that have GBLT, GLBT issues, and, you know, even though that, you know, being homosexual or whatever has been taken out of the DSM way back in the 70s, psychiatrists still see that as a mental health issue.
Right,
how
and
many
there are some places like Texas that just, like Texas that just passed the AOK for conversion therapy and torture for people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. It's
reports like that lead these people to commit suicide because it is a hopeless situation when you hear, you go on the internet, you open the TV, and you hear what you are is wrong and has to be changed. And the thing is, whether you're a gay, lesbian, or transgendered, or bisexual, or if you're just someone who likes to wear a long beard or dye your hair different or dress up in golf, you know, whatever it is that makes you feel comfortable, if it's not along societal's standards, you obviously have a problem and most likely a mental health problem, and it needs to be changed. The thing is we're all very diverse people, and this is all about accepting differences in people because there are always going to be differences in people. And I can't tell you, you know, they think just because you don't look the part, you can't be smart. But I have had psychiatrists tell me, obviously, Maria, you're very intelligent. And I'm like, okay, so intelligent people can't have mental health issues, or only intelligent people aren't unique individuals in themselves, and they always look, intelligent people always wear VP suits or dress executively, and, you know, what does an intelligent person look like, you know? Just because you might look like a hippie or a Samuel Adams or a Sasquatch, or whether or not you bathe or you don't bathe every day, doesn't make you more or less intelligent. It makes you different from the next guy. That's all it makes you. And in society, they can't accept and respect differences as a whole. As a whole. Thank God there are groups of people
The intolerance.
That can.
just the intolerance. And then the idea of the whole push toward tolerance and the damage that that did, because who wants to be tolerated, you know? And so really accepting people is what we need. And this.
Yes.
That's the key,
is accepting people for who they are, even if they're different from who you are. It's like the whole theory, grouping people by economic status, you know, Section 8, where there's a whole Section 8 building. These people are all on Section 8. Or the mental health centers having a whole apartment buildings just with mentally ill people. And then whole apartment buildings who are just 62 or older. Why are we segregating the world that way when clearly if 200-300 years ago, all those differences were integrated in one family, in one society? So I hate living in a Section 8 building because, unfortunately, the stigma or the stereotype is true. You live in a Section 8 building, it is dirty, it is vandalized, it is bug-ridden, it is not a nice place to live. Okay? I've lived in too many and they've all been that way. And it's stereotype, but it's a truth. Because I always respect where I live, but why should someone respect where they live when they feel they're there only because it's a way to keep them down? And you're grouped together with everyone else who is poor. And then when you live in an apartment building where all the people there have a mental health diagnosis, that is a crazy place to live. I chose to go into a homeless shelter instead of a group home because I would rather take my chances on the 10% of the population in the shelter that might be crazy, you know, that term crazy, to 100% of this much smaller amount of people who are crazy, because I've done both. And those group homes have one person on staff and it can get very hectic. The shelter I went into, there might have been 100 of us women, but there were 3 security guards there and a zero tolerance. If you did something and said to them, well, I was in my symptoms, too bad, you're back out in the street. In a group home, oh, I'm sorry, I was in my symptoms, and there's no penalty for doing something that was inappropriate, whether you have a mental illness or not. It's clear there are certain things that are inappropriate. You don't disrespect other people. You don't attack other people. You don't put down other people. And then to do that and then use the excuse, I was in my mental health symptoms, it is wrong. But these are the things that happen out there.
I can say this is mental, whatever you call it, emotional distress, or whatever you use it, is not an excuse for bad behavior. And that goes back to what I was saying about, and I know that it's difficult and hard, but to at all times to act as if we deserve to be treated well and to come with that and that we deserve to be in a clean place or whatever else.
Well, I obviously believe I deserve to be treated well because I demand it. It's not given.
That because of the discrimination that people face, that they're not given the basics, and so the environment creates these conditions that are deplorable for people to be living in, and then it becomes very easy for people to discriminate against themselves and to accept the degrading life that they've been awarded and then become part of the, you know, stereotype of how it is that people with psychiatric histories are.
We have to think outside the box, too, because what happens is sometimes we get so caught up in our misery, not saying these things are valid, but it's like this. You have, I've seen this, you'll have 3 or 4 people that are roommates in a group home, and they've been there for a long time. I give this example because this is a true example. I've known people like this, and what happens is when you say to them, well, you know, the group home is getting like $1,000 plus whatever, a month. They take all of their check. This is how they work in where I live. They can take up to all their check at least, except for $100. And if they don't get quite what the base, the group home operator doesn't get quite, the city will match. So they take all their money. And I would say to people, well, this person is your roommate in the same room with you and somebody else that you like. Why? And these are older women. I says, do you ever think that maybe you might go and get a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment and you could come out cheaper? You would be able to even have a housekeeper, someone to come in clean once a week or whatever else. And sometimes we are so enchained. You know, you made a comment about how benefits keeps the person chained because we sometimes think that only the people who have been designated to help us with housing, only the people who are designated to help us with employment, that those are the only people. And
no.
And those
Listen,
with their...
you're doing what you yourself, what you think people shouldn't do to you, because I'll tell you, I just got out in June. I just got out of the assisted living situation, and it was another person who has been diagnosed in the past with a mental health diagnosis who helped me get out of there by helping me and by supplying me a place to live, and it's working out wonderfully. But the thing was, is I was in the assisted living, and it was a rare assisted living because I had my own room to myself. But I had to eat with 60 other people. And
right.
I saw the staff treat other people such right. in a deplorable manner. You imagine telling a 70-year-old person who, you know, or even a 50-year-old person that, oh, you're not going to get more food because you didn't eat what was on your plate, regardless if you liked the food or not. Being told what a statement was a lie, being called a liar, being totally disrespected, and then telling the management staff and them saying to me, we understand the problem, we're working on it, and it's deplorable the way it is. But it was much worse in the past, and this is actually a much better than it was. And why are these people still here? Because the people who were acting this way, totally disrespectful, totally, put it this way, totally, oh, it's horrible. I couldn't watch it. I stopped going to the dining room and scavenged for food, which you got to remember, as a person in there, and paying everything in my check but the $100. What you're talking about, I lived, okay? And I scavenged around between drop-in centers and resource centers and homeless day centers for meals, because when I ate meals at the assisted living, I got sick because of the way these people were treating. Not me. I went up to someone who was just being treated very poorly, and I was alone with her on the elevator, and I said, why do you stand for that? And she said, well, if they're picking on me, they can't pick on you. And I said, no, when they're picking on you, I know they're going to come for me next. And she said, well, they would never pick on you because you'd probably smack them in the face. And I'm like, no, I'm not violent. I won't hurt another person. But, yes, I would answer them back. Yes,
and
I would do something about the poor behavior.
And these people are the people that are usually have the least training.
Yes. And the people that were doing the mistreatment where I went, was living, were people who had been employed there the longest. So these people were there 6-8 years, and they couldn't just fire them because of the way the whole system was. But the whole attitude of the management is, They've been here for a while. We want to give them the chance to develop a better way of doing things. And I was like, that's not how you do it. You tell them you do this again and you will no longer have a job. Or you got three chances. But clearly these people were doing it on such a regular basis. I was only there from January to June, and I could not tolerate the way they were treating the clients. And believe me, the other clients were sad to see me go because I was friendly there. I talked to the other people. I was even told by the other residents, you know, you always dress nice. You always go out. You never just sit around. You're always participating in groups. It's nice to see that. But the majority of people, sit there and just watch the paint peel. Mm-hmm. So I have been where you're saying what you're talking about. And there are ways to get out of there. And I thank God for my friend who stepped above her situation because she had it tough too and was willing to help me out of that. And it's working out, thank God, because I have a temperament that is understanding, and I'm not a borderline personality person because if I did, me and my friend would not be able to last one day, okay? And the thing is the community of people who have been diagnosed supporting one another. Even, you know, I'm in the midst of withdrawing from drugs. It hasn't been 2 years yet. But I know when I have those old symptoms come popping up, it's not that I need to go and get some meds. I know that that's only happening because the meds aren't completely out of my system. And all I need to do is hold on for a little bit longer, and those things will diminish or go away. And I've learned skills how to deal with symptoms that might pop up that are actually from the drugs. I mean, there are a lot of things in this world that are like that, just not to go off track, but just an example, fluoride in our drinking water, okay? And
right.
They use fluoride to control the concentration camp people. So it's not just about people mentally ill being treated poorly. The government or the powers that be, whether it be actual government people or some kind of conspiracy, it's hard because you hear these reports. What do you believe? What do you act on? Because, you know, some of this stuff does sound too unreal to be true. But we all know that fluoride's in the water. We also know that dental care has gotten worse. We all know that mercury, that the amalgam filling is so filled with mercury, it's making people sick, and it still continues. The fluoride,
right,
the amalgamating filling, especially if you're poor.
And that there's an absolute intention to screen all people and get all people involved with psychiatry. And I just want to flag people again and remind them about this Gottfried Krueger maternal depression legislation that passed in both houses. And that Liz Krueger, I don't know what Liz Krueger is thinking with this, but the idea that all women, that first of all, they rewrote the definition of postpartum depression and are now calling it maternal depression, and they're saying that it can start as early as a month or two into the pregnancy, and that the symptoms of this is panic and anxiety, which I don't know how any woman who is pregnant wouldn't experience some feelings of panic and anxiety. And that it's also going to open up the door to screening their children and getting their children in early psychiatric treatment because, you know, they're the children of somebody who has a psychiatric history. And then you compare that with, or you couple that with the public health law in New York that allows the state to take your child away from you simply because you have a psychiatric history. And now we're creating another line of genocide where one of the requirements of genocide is taking away the children of a certain group of people and giving them to another group of people. And so this is really concerning because, and, you know, we're asking people to call Governor Cuomo at 518-474-8390 and tell him to veto this legislation, the Gottfried Kruger maternal depression legislation, because it's just setting all of these women up to be, drugged, and the potential of then having their child taken away from them. And so that this extends, that this isn't, this whole thing and anybody who winds up in this system, it's not limited to some, quote-unquote, psychiatric disorder or, that is often based in fraud, the idea that, anybody is subject to this, and that the states are figuring out more and more ways in order to target people. And to have them, be evaluated. So these screenings that will be done by general practitioners, family doctors, and OBGYNs, and that there will be, material set out for them, that this is a real issue, and that they say that, that these women need close monitoring and evaluation. It's also, if you're a woman who has a psychiatric history, that there is a closer attention that is paid. And so it says screening for diagnosing and treating depression have the potential to benefit a woman and her family. Pregnancy and the postpartum period represent an ideal time during which consistent contact with healthcare professionals will allow women at risk to be identified and treated. Women with current depression or a history of major depression warrant particularly close monitoring and evaluation. And so, this entire other population of people that they're going after, just being a woman puts you at greater risk now for this, and being a pregnant woman where they can then take your child away from you at birth. And I know, I've been told that they're, if you're at a facility or an institution or a program that does this, that you see this being done, to get out, because that's what they do. So to not even report that. But Maria, the original issue that you called in about the fear of going to a doctor and having the doctor then see your psychiatric history and disregard anything else, of what do you do when you're receiving Medicaid or Medicare around that, and the doctors aren't holistic, doctors are homeopathic or offering alternatives, and all they're offering you is a quick 15-minute, here's the drug and get out. I think that this is a major public health issue in itself. The idea that you're then put on drugs that cause weight gain, that cause all these problems, and that people are being disregarded. And I wish I had, a clear answer for you as to what do you do and how do you go about doing it, and I really don't, other than trying to research what the limited options within Medicaid and Medicare are for what doctors are available to you, and then trying to, narrow out. But then you're often in a situation of where you're choosing between the lesser of two evils, right? And that the people, and because these other issues that you brought up around how society looks at people, and devalues and judges people who are receiving public assistance, that the original, that there's another added level of discrimination that people are subjected to, and it
is a Colorado Republican state. Is Colorado a Republican state?
Right now I believe it's a Democratic state. It goes back and forth. But it really shouldn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat. I will tell you, a lot of Democrats perpetuate the stigma, and the Republicans, as far as I'm concerned, it's more about money than true help. It may be easier to help in a restrictive way than to not help at all. It might actually be more costly.
Medicaid is
the thing
is
whether you're Republican or Democrat, it really doesn't matter. I'm more and more convinced every day that the president isn't the one really calling the shots. who is actually calling the shots, the theories are vast. But I do know that money talks, poverty walks, and the other thing is, I voted for Obama the first time. I had great hopes and desires for this man, and as far as I'm concerned, he sold out. Because if he stood up for the change that he was talking about, it wouldn't matter who is behind all this. He would have stood up and done something about change. Now, some may say he's doing that now, but as a lame duck president, he's making declarations that are pissing off a lot of people and passing things, not passing laws, but making presidential decisions on his own without the legislative government, which is a crooked way too. So
right.
What is true democracy? I don't know. But
and they're all
well,
the same.
Healthcare.
I mean, on either side, it doesn't matter. And because in Republican administrations, we tend to fare better in some ways because they don't want to spend the money. And the, you know, good progressives are thinking that they're, you know, helping us poor people. And so they just add more and more and more. But that we're being legislated to death, there's no two ways around it. And, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, when this kicks in, and everybody's going to be mandated to, you know, mental health screenings and drug and alcohol screenings and, you know, then maybe people will pay attention because generally if you go through one of these, you're going to come out with a psychiatric diagnosis. And so it's a wide reaching.
One of the things about going back to the postpartum depression, for, at least one thing is where I live, we have had for many years. Medicaid is 200% of poverty, 200% of poverty. And Medicaid programs vary from state to state. In some places like Arizona, you know, you could be very, very poor and not qualify for Medicaid. But getting back to the postpartum depression, my thing is if they screen, I think it's bad enough. But just like AOT, additional service doesn't come along with it. And in the District of Columbia, if you're on Medicaid, for example, the doctor can write an order so that you can have a health care aide come when the baby come home for 2 weeks, or if it's a cesarean, longer. You know, when I was my grandmother was one of her careers, the job she had was a midwife. And midwifery is a little bit different than people think about now, about people just having a child being birthed. They would go to the person's home and they'd be there with the child. It is very stressful for some people to have children, especially if they have small children at home. I don't like using the word postpartum depression, you know, but, you know, if you've got a person who's got 3 or 4 kids under the age of 5, I mean, that's not going to make me depressed if I have another baby on the way and I have to take care of it. I don't know what it is. My thing is, when they screen for these things, just like when they say AOT treatment, we have to pay very careful attention to it because sometimes the way to attack it is not just that it's providing a screening, but once the screening is done and they have designated that someone is at risk or whatever, what do they do with that? Do they provide extra service? Will they provide
for that mother?
Well, yeah,
no, this also funds treatment. And then, I mean, the other thing that is really of concern is that there is a quote here from Dr. Daniel Larocque, who's an MD, FAAP, New York State AAP chair. She says, this is in Kruger's press release, it says, therefore, it makes sense to create a process for pediatricians to screen and refer new mothers who may be struggling with postpartum depression. Early screening and identification of maternal depression has 80% to 90% success rate and offers long-term healthcare cost savings. It also helps support healthy child development and addresses issues of early childhood mental health challenges. And so they are not only going after mothers, but they are going after the children of these mothers. And that, you know, the bill is providing for treatment. And what's treatment? Treatment is either drugs or electroshock. That is
What is driving this thing? What is driving Are people seeing a lot of this in their practice? Or is this Andrea Yates all over again? I mean, what is driving it?
I think what Lisa called up last night and talked about as part of driving it is the Freedom Incentives Act that it mandates that all Americans are mental health screened, that all Americans have mental health screenings. And so this is one of the ways to do it, because we now see them extending it also to all people who are incarcerated with the new law that just came out in New York, and so that's it. But the way that they are doing it in the legislation is that they're using, you know, an instance here, an instance there of extreme, horrific, heinous violence of a mother against her child, and now, you know, putting that a net over all women who don't even need a psychiatric history for this anymore. All you need to be screened for this is that you're pregnant. So and then if you do have a psychiatric history, you're at a greater risk of being targeted for this, because that's who they also want you to pay attention to. But this is not limited to people who have psychiatric histories. This is any woman who is pregnant. And, you know, when you take into consideration, like, the National Alliance on Mental Illness's push for women who have been diagnosed with, quote-unquote, bipolar to be have electroshock because of the damage that the drugs do to the fetus, this is very concerning, and it's something that we need to keep an eye on. And I don't think it's been signed into legislation by Governor Cuomo yet. And, again, his number is 518-474-8390, I think. And to call him and to have him veto the Gottfried Kruger maternal depression legislation. And I hope in the future that I know there have been a couple of different major activities that have been taken on by different peer-run organizations around new mothers' issues and support and peer support for new mothers, and perhaps we can do a show in the future specifically on this legislation and concerns that people have around how do you assist somebody who may be having some kind of emotional questions about this new pregnancy that they're experiencing, and how do you get natural alternative supports. And why are things like panic and anxiety now, you know, because a woman is pregnant and is experiencing some sense of anxiety about that pregnancy to be diagnosed?
No, it's been around for a long time. I don't know why they're running about. Are there any announcements as we go to the closing of the show? What's any specials coming up on the Lauren Kenny Open Dialogue?
Oh, yes. On June 26th, we're going to have Dr. Bonnie Burstow, who from Canada, from University of Toronto, who's been an anti-psychiatry activist for 35 years, and she's going to be discussing a lot of different things, including some projects that she's been involved in, Psychiatry Disrupted, her new upcoming book, Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. And she's been involved in really a lot of anti-shock kind of work for 35 years and has been a feminist therapist and calling attention to what happens to women in psychiatry. And so that will be that'll be June 26th from 8 to 10 p.m. It will be a special. I just want to say also July 9th, we're going to have a special with Katherine Hine and Aubrey Nchomo on judicial accountability and the jury trial, and I will be getting more information about that out soon. If people have an idea for a show, would like to be a guest, or have a tip that they would like to call in, the tip line is area code 718-273-8708. It's area code 718-273-8708. I want to thank everybody for calling in, Maria and Yvonne, and all who have been listening. And I'm going to ask you to keep on talking and speaking out about this. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon.